Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict meets with participants at a Catholic press congress that's been going on here in Rome this week. Hear more about how journalists are coping with the current print media crisis and the long-term impact of the Holy Father's recent visit to the United Kingdom. Stay tuned as I sit down with the British government coordinator for that visit, Lord Chris Patton.
La ricerca della verità deve essere perseguita dai giornalisti cattolici con mente e cuore appassionati.
Catholic journalists must pursue the truth with passionate hearts and minds, but also with professional competence and with the necessary means at their disposal. Those were Pope Benedict's words on Thursday to participants at a Catholic press congress that's been taking place here in the Vatican this week. Editors, journalists and media experts from over 80 countries around the world have been discussing the challenges of providing quality information about the Church in a world marked by secularization, a severe financial crisis, and the proliferation of alternative online news sources.
Infatti, le nuove tecnologie, assieme ai progressi che portano, possono rendere interscambiabili il vero e il falso.
In his reflections to the group, the Pope said, in a world where instant images are available online, the real world is increasingly confused with virtual reality, and events are often sensationalized rather than offering any serious analysis. Since the Christian message is based upon the incarnate word, the Pope said, the written word can express better than any other means the message of our salvation. Just as God's word was handed down to us over the centuries through the written words of the Bible, so the press continues to play a fundamental role even in this era of digital images.
E anche nella cosiddetta civiltà dell'immagine conserva tutto intero il suo valore.
But just how is the Catholic press coping with the pressures of modern technology and rapidly changing readership habits that are provoking the most profound cultural changes since the printing press was introduced to the Western world over five centuries ago? That question was at the heart of the four-day Congress, which brought together experts from around the world, from traditionally Catholic countries to places where Christians make up just a tiny minority. Sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, the meeting, which opened on Monday, was a work in progress, discussing how to be more effectively present in this digital era, how to report on controversy, and above all, how to rediscover the essential mission of the press at the service of the Church and the wider community. At the start of the meeting, I talked to the president of the Pontifical Council, Archbishop Claudio Celi.
I think that our council is analyzing quite closely the situation that we have now with the press. And I think that the problem is not only related to the Catholic press, but for the press itself. In this digital era, I think that many challenges are posed to the press as such. It is quite well known that many people today, they prefer to read the newspaper through their internet, through their PC, because I think that is more comfortable. And so we have that normally the big newspapers, they have more readers through the PC than through a copy of the newspaper itself. And certainly the digital era is creating new tensions and new challenges. And our council was eager to understand. You know, I think that our congresses are not just to tell something, but we are eager to know more, to understand what is happening around the world, to listen at our people. We don't have many answers to give. I think that the goal of this Congress is to understand each other, to understand what is happening, and to find together some solutions.
Do you think this crisis, these challenges facing all the big national newspapers, as you say, makes it easier for the smaller world, perhaps, of the Catholic press to make its voice heard?
We realize that we are facing some difficulties. For example, also in big countries where we have some Catholic newspapers at the national level, they are decreasing the number of copies sold or received by the people. And because, as I told you already, many people today, young people, the young generations, are more accustomed to stay in front of a PC. I have many friends of mine who are no more getting the copy of a newspaper, but they are having many newspapers in their PC, and they can have a wider angle. But today, I think that the Catholic press also is facing new challenges. You know, in a period of our history where relativism is dominating, we have today already a multicultural or a multi-religious perspective. We have to find again and again what is the mission of a Catholic press. I think that people, all our people, are invited to rediscover their mission, and especially today. Sometimes, as you can imagine, around the world, the church is always connected with difficult situations. And also, the news that are given are fragmented, are sometimes deviated or distorted, are not well understood. And sometimes also some presence of the church in the media is connected with some special or particular interests. And so I think that today the Catholic press has to recover, to understand more and more in a clearer way what is her mission. And I think that here is the meaning of our Congress. As you can imagine, we have 85 countries represented. Many countries are coming from the developing sector. Some others are coming from the super developed sector of the world. But all of them, they have the same mission. The problem is to see how they face the new challenges.
It requires some very creative investment, doesn't it, in terms of money and also personnel to be able to face these challenges.
I think that the problem is not the technology again, but we are stressing the importance of the human factor. Again, I think that people with a Christian heart or a Catholic heart, they have to share what their fellow men or fellow women are experiencing. And in such a moment, in such a development, in this common road, they have to enlighten the situation with the light of the gospel. It is not an easy task, because sometimes also the meaning is to find how Jesus is giving a proper answer to the human questions of today. I, for example, am stressing a special aspect of our life, but I'm saying that sometimes our prophetic role is not so clear. Sometimes also we adjust ourselves to the common trend of society. It's not easy to find a way how to be present, what to say, how to say what we feel. And because sometimes we perceive that we are not so well accepted. It is, for me, very, very important what Paul was saying to his disciple Timothy. Don't be afraid.
Don't be ashamed.
Don't be ashamed, exactly, to be witness of the gospel. And I think that today this is just the same also for the Catholic press.
One of the areas that you're discussing is precisely the freedom of expression and the truth of the church. It's quite a difficult question, isn't it, in the light of the difficulties over, for example, the sex abuse scandals and the criticism that was levelled at the media by so many church leaders?
Yeah. Can you imagine that the church was defined as expert in humanity? And for sure, some members of the church were giving a negative example of this expression. They were not expert in humanity. And I think that such a position, such a situation, can weaken our mission, and so is creating more difficulties. But I think that, again, we must rediscover how the word of Jesus is challenging us and is helping us to rediscover that we are not announcing ourselves, but we are announcing Jesus. And so I would say that we are weak, we are poor, but I think that also in this sad situation, again, is present the light of our Lord Jesus Christ. And I think that the church is having in this moment an experience of poverty and weakness, but is also rediscovering that what we have in our hands, in our heart, is Jesus himself. And I think that this is our task. And I think that also in the field of media, we must be present. Not because we want to show what we are. We don't have to express our strength. I think that also here we have to rediscover that the Catholic press is at the service of society. And I think that in this difficult situation, because not only the church is in difficulty, I think that mankind today is facing difficulties. Our life is fragmented. We are not sure of tomorrow. It is a very clear situation of humanity today. We don't know what can happen tomorrow. And our life is immersed in very continuous tensions. And I think that the role of the Catholic press, like of the Church today, is to recall, to remind our people that God is present, that God is love, that God is happy when we are reaching the fulfillment of our life. Like a father that is happy when his children are realizing something good in their life. And so I think that this is the challenge of the Catholic press today also, to share the human road that of everybody and to remind to everybody that there is a way of breathing in a different way because we have a hope in our heart.
Archbishop Claudio Celi there, President of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. One of the keynote speakers at the Congress was Greg Erlandson, president of Our Sunday Visitor Publishing Company in the United States and co-author of a book on Pope Benedict and the sexual abuse crisis. He told me how he believes the Catholic press can more effectively respond to the crises and the challenges it faces today.
In the United States, I think there is a crisis. It's in many ways a crisis of resources, and it's also a crisis in terms of the competition that it's receiving from other sectors of the communications industry. I mean, one of the most common complaints both of secular and Catholic media is that the readers no longer have time. They stop reading because they no longer have time for this. They're spending more and more of their time on the internet, more and more time with terms of social media, so the church and Catholic media have to figure out how to be there. The challenge remains is that if people go to the internet or go to the web, they're not necessarily looking for Catholic materials. Interesting anecdote is that if you go to YouTube and put in Catholic, the first really Catholic item is something like why I'm a Catholic, and there's 200,000 hits or something. But the most popular is a Britney Spears song in which she's dressed up in a Catholic uniform, and that has millions of hits. And so that's what you see is the paradox here.
How would you say then, is the press, particularly in the United States, in your context, responding to this enormous challenge, as you say, of providing quality information about the church?
I think that the Catholic press in the United States realizes, as the secular press does, is that you no longer allowed to pick one channel and not another channel for distribution. It's not either or, it's both and. That's where enormous amount of stress is, frankly, because it's very expensive to be able to do sort of a multi-channel presentation. But I believe what's happening is that people are finding ways, either through partnerships or collaborations with each other, or in small entrepreneurial projects, to be able to find new ways of communicating. For example, now we are starting to do e-books. We have an arrangement with Kindle, so we do, and Amazon, so we do books for Kindle, and we're testing that approach. Right now, it's not very important in terms of a revenue stream, but it's important for us to be able to try to do that. The same with blogs, the same with Twitter, Facebook, all of these things. You have to have an entrepreneurial mindset or an experimental mindset, not to be afraid to try some things and to fail. But the real dilemma is, without stronger financial support, this is very, very difficult to make a success of. And what we're witnessing in much of the Catholic press in our country is that either the bishops, when they own the press, are cutting back on their investment, or because of declining circulation, many publishing houses are not able to support their enterprises the way they once did. So that continues to be, I think, one of the strongest threats to the Catholic press adapting to this new reality.
My thanks there to Greg Erlandson, president of Our Sunday Visitor Publishing Company. The British government coordinator for the recent papal visit to the United Kingdom, Lord Chris Patten, was here in Rome this past weekend for a conference on the future of European society. I sat down with him to look back at the success of that visit, which exceeded the expectations of so many, and about the serious debate he hopes it will continue to generate within British society.
I think pretty well every visit His Holiness has made has been preceded by rather sceptical commentary on how it's going to go, and then it's proved to be very successful. I was in the United States when he went there, and the visit was a huge triumph. I think the reasons for the success were principally threefold. First of all, His Holiness himself. I mean, a lot of the commentary has rather slid past the point that this was a hugely tiring, demanding programme, which he managed with great elan, in a language with which, to no criticism, he's not comfortable. And to have done it all as wonderfully well as he did is a great tribute to him personally. Secondly, it was in a sense a stick in the eye for metropolitan cynicism. What made the trip a success from the very beginning was the turnout of the crowds, Catholic and non-Catholic alike, who wanted to wish him well. And for some of us, the most wonderful sight was not just the social mix of worshippers at the masses and the vigil, but the young kids. I mean, very normal teenagers with funny T-shirts and banners and enjoying themselves. The organizers of the event in Hyde Park had expected it to be like the normal proms in the park, a sort of concert, a classical concert, you know, and rather staid and middle class. They were amazed when it turned into something like a pop concert. But even so, at moments, there was complete silence during the vigil. So that was one of the reasons for the success. Thirdly, I think not just the messenger and the people to whom the message was delivered, but the message itself. Thoughtful, quite challenging. But I can't remember a recent visit by any world figure which has left behind so much debate about really serious issues. So I think from our point of view, as the Prime Minister made clear when Pope Benedict was leaving Birmingham, I think it was a huge success.
As you say, it was indeed an action-packed 4 days, a very intense programme. What perhaps were your personal highlights?
I most enjoyed the Friday and Saturday morning. First of all, the speech in Westminster Hall, which is a building which is iconic, really, in British history. The building where Thomas More, said to be the patron saint of politicians, because he's a man of conscience. Unfortunately, none of politicians perhaps are. But an iconic building in British history. And the Pope made this very, very interesting speech about the relationship between faith and reason and the rule of law in a moderate, tolerant society. Then we went across the road, as it were, for the great ecumenical service in Westminster Abbey. And I will never forget, I'm married to a member of the Church of England, and for her it was, and for both of us, it was a moment of great joy when the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope entered that wonderful medieval building to the sound of the Church's one foundation. Was Church of England liturgy at its finest. And then the following morning, we had that wonderful mass in Westminster Cathedral with a great piece of music to open it by James McMillan, the Scottish composer, Tuas Petrus, which took the roof off the cathedral. There were a lot of very good moments as well. But those for me were the highlights.
As you said, the Pope left behind some quite challenging questions, didn't he? If you had to suggest perhaps what might be the longer term impact of the visit, what would you like to see coming out of it?
I'd like to see members of faith groups, first of all, recognizing the wisdom of what the chief rabbi said. One of the characteristics of the visit was the very fine speeches which it elicited from others, and in particular, the chief rabbi and the Archbishop of Canterbury made some extraordinarily good speeches. And the chief rabbi noted that one of the things that put people off faith was the difficulty that faith groups had over the years in working together and not fighting one another. It was put much more elegantly than that. So I think first of all, faith groups, I hope, will recognise what they have in common, and we're really talking principally about, not entirely, but principally about groups which have their paternity in Abraham. Secondly, I hope that it will make people who belong to faith groups more self-confident about saying so. And I hope we'll end some of the, you know, these things may be exaggerated sometime, but these sort of ridiculous ways in which alleged political correctness has led to the siege of people who belong to faith groups. You know, that ridiculous and rather awful business a few years ago when an employee of British Airways was stopped from wearing a crucifix. I also hope that it will encourage secularists to be serious rather than abusive. It was, for me, rather a disappointment to see people who are serious, or said to be serious, professors and lawyers getting involved in the most abusive commentary. I mean, not many of them, but a few, about the Catholic Church and about religion in general. And I hope that they will recognise that there's actually a serious debate to be had, that the Pope and the Catholic Church want to get in a serious debate, not a debate in which the Catholic Church says it wants to run everything, but a debate in which people who do belong to faith groups say, look, you know, we have a contribution to make to creating ethical foundations for politics and policy making. So I hope those things will result from the visit.
So really raising the tone, perhaps, of the debate between faith and reason. It's an optimistic a hope.
Yes, it is a bit optimistic because we are said to live in a world of 24-hour news cycles, of sound bites. Well, we shouldn't allow that to crimp and confine intelligent discussion and debate. One of my favourite remarks by a politician was Adlai Stevenson's observation that the average man and woman is a great deal better than the average. And it's nice to hear people like the Archbishop of Canterbury and His Holiness and the Chief Rabbi acting on that. I wish a few more politicians would.
What about reactions from within the Catholic community there in Britain? Certainly the Pope was appealing for a much more vibrant debate between faith and reason, and it seemed that people in Britain were listening to what he had to say. Do you think the other way round is also true? Do you think, in a sense, the Pope was able to hear the very distinctive voice of the Catholic Church in Britain today?
I very much hope so. I hope that he will have been as impressed as I was by the sign of the vitality of the Catholic Church and a point I made earlier, its enormous range. You look at those queues of people going up for communion, every age, every social class, every colour, every race, an extraordinary social mix and a great deal of joy about the way people were celebrating their religion. Joy even in the soggiest circumstances before the Mass in Birmingham, and being reminded on that occasion of one of the greatest of England's Catholics. It started so magnificently in Edinburgh and that great park in Glasgow with the cheering crowds and the yellow and white flags alongside the blue and white crosses of St Andrew. It started wonderfully well there, and I hope that from that moment on, His Holiness and his colleagues from the Vatican will have been impressed by what they saw of the vitality of English and Scottish Catholicism.
There are those within the Catholic Church in Britain who are very keen to engage in this debate, and yet somehow, perhaps women particularly, feel that their voices aren't heard here in the Vatican.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I want to avoid turning myself into a commentator on the precise state of the Catholic Church. There are people who feel very passionately about issues like gender, the role of women in the church, a church which wouldn't exist had it not been for the way women behaved on Good Friday and when all the men ran away. There are people who are very worried about attitudes to gays in the church. I mean, I've always assumed myself that there are a lot of devout gays in the Catholic Church and that God must love them particularly strongly because of the extent of discrimination that they've felt over the years, not least in the past from parts of the Catholic Church itself. So all those issues, of course, get discussed, and I hope are discussed in a way which doesn't open divisions within the church itself and in a way which doesn't ever take away from our fundamental agreement about the most important aspect of our religion being the resurrection.
Finally, you're here in Rome for this Congress discussing the future of European society, of course, one of the Pope's deepest concerns. What else do you think the churches can do to become more effective players on the European stage?
It's interesting that if you look back to the foundations of the European Union, and it's perhaps something that made people in my own country a bit suspicious of it in the past, many of the founding fathers were very strong intellectual Catholics, and a lot of the foundations of the European Union you can trace to Catholic social teaching over the last 100 or so years, concepts like subsidiarity. So I think that religion, Catholicism, has played a large part in the way that the European Union has been created. I don't mean by that that we should assign the common agricultural policy to the catechism, but I do think that religion has played an important part. And I hope it will play an important part in the next few years in ensuring that the European Union isn't inward-looking, continues to be extrovert, and continues to offer a model of living which combines prosperity with social solidarity and political stability. Those are all, I would have hoped, the aims and objectives. We face huge challenges in Europe, not least because we have a falling share of the world's population, a stuttering underlying rate of growth, and may well find ourselves over the next few years, as a result of those things, with a falling share of world trade and world output as well, and therefore not perhaps as well placed to offer lessons and advice to the rest of the world. So there's plenty for us to do, but I think also plenty of inspiration to take from Catholic philosophers and the Catholic tradition.
My thanks there to Lord Chris Patton, the British government's coordinator for the recent visit of Pope Benedict to the United Kingdom. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.